Please be seated, won't you? Beth's going to help me out a little bit here at the beginning of the sermon. Give her just a second. Today in the house of David, will Joab send Uriah to his death? Will David seduce his wife? Who will have a child? Watch as we find out more in today's episode of The House of David. It's great to have musicians that can do that on the on this fry. Whenever I read the Hebrew Scriptures, it sometimes feels a little bit like a soap opera. But actually, when you dig a little deeper, it seems very human. Because if we began to look around, even though this particular time is very much a different culture than we live in, there certainly is lots of human drama around us all the time. And in this particular story, we hear of David, who is the king, who is the one who is to build the great temple for God, the place that God will dwell. We hear of his awfulness, of his sin, of his human failings. And I think sometimes when we read this, we often forget that if you engage the Scriptures at any depth, you find, particularly in the Old Testament, a couple of consistent themes. There is a call to be faithful. There is a call to follow commandment. And almost all the time, there is a story of the failure to do both, then followed by reconciliation with God and renewed sense of covenant. I think about that, and I sometimes wonder if in our own lives we really are willing to recognize that we are probably a lot more like David than we'd want to admit. We're probably someone who might have some sin in our lives, some difficulty, some limitation, or some failing. We don't always live up to being faithful to God. We don't always live up to the commandments that we might find. And if we take away from this story just the judgment, we miss the grace that's there also. Now, there's a little interesting part that if you were to continue reading, there's a lot more to the story in the further episodes. David eventually begins to recognize his failings. But at the same time, there's a curse that kind of befalls his house, and this particular episode causes great division and great difficulty among his children and among those who are allies with him. And at one point, things seem completely lost, and a prophet comes to him and calls him back to where he's to be, Nathan, and says, "You've got it all wrong." He challenges the king. "You've failed miserably." And then eventually David finds his way back to the temple. And this is the prayer. You're going to recognize this. This is the prayer that is attributed directly to this particular story that he prays in the temple. "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my sins, and my sins are always before me. Against you only have I sinned and done what is evil. So you are right in your verdict. Cleanse me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face from me, and blot out all my iniquity. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me." This prayer, born of David's difficulty, is a prayer that we pray on Ash Wednesday and during the season of Lent in particular. And what I love about it is it a prayer of contriteness before God. And if you've ever been at that point in your life, which you may have been, you know that pleading that is there. The Latin translation of that psalm, it's Psalm 51, if you're interested, is even, it's better. It really cries out, it's miserere me. I am so miserable. God, show me your mercy. And I know that in your goodness, you will bless me. And if you've ever been in a life where you might have sinned, or if you've ever had that moment, then you know that we need that grace that God offers. Now imagine yourself among the crowd of the 5,000. And you're in that place. You can just, I've been to this particular place that we've heard of in the scriptures. I love being able to say that, by the way. I've been to that particular place. There's hills on both sides. And if the wind gathers any speed, the Sea of Galilee, which is really a big lake, becomes quite rough. And the boat that they're in is not the boat that you would see down at the Lake of the Ozarks that creates the waves. It's a tiny little wooden boat that would have had maybe a foot or so of wood above the water. And it's a place that's filled with grass that looks kind of like the grass in the Flint Hills, soft and breezy. And there Jesus is ministering, and the people come and they press upon him. And imagine yourself for a moment in that crowd and hearing grace, hearing of healing, hearing as an enslaved person, as a person who might have been cast out, that you are loved by God, and how much you might have desired just to get close to the person of Jesus, just to reach out, just to be there. Now, have any of you ever had a hungry group of people around you? You know, like after you've been traveling for a while or you've been out working for the day and you've just kind of maybe missed one meal, how hungry people get? Now, most of us in our culture do not experience real hunger, okay? But these people would have known real hunger. They might not have eaten for a day or two, and there's a lot of them, not just one or two, and they're hungry. Hungry people get testy. They get frustrated. And the apostles are worried. And this story shows up in several of the Gospels. The apostles are concerned. They come to Jesus in one story, and they say, what are we going to do? And in this particular one, Jesus starts the question. He says, well, how are we going to do this, guys? What's the problem? And in this story, a boy comes up. And they say, you know, this is all we could find. All we have, Jesus, all we have. We don't have enough. There's 5,000 people. We have what? 2 and 5. What are you going to do, buddy? Because they're hungry. Are you into the story now? And Jesus says, go ahead. Start passing it out. Now imagine for yourself somewhere in about the 15th row back. Hungry, probably hot, tired, dusty. And you see people begin to share food. Maybe you have some with you. Maybe you don't. But suddenly, everyone around you seems to have enough. In fact, there's more than enough. And at the end of the story, they gather up the crumbs, and there's baskets to overflowing. I can't explain the miracle. I can have ideas and interpretations. But there's something that happens in that moment. And isn't it really about God's grace? About God's love and God's care for us? You see, when we're hungry in our soul, or we're in those moments where we're pleading for God, we're hungry for those fishes and those loaves, that we might have a taste. And then someone shares with us. If someone reaches out, if someone gives us that moment and that moment of sharing, we can find it. A good friend of mine named Christopher Grundy is a contemporary musician, and he writes and has lots of music published by the United Church of Christ. And he wrote a song recently called Come to the Feast, and I just want to share some of the lyrics with you. It says, come to the feast, there's always room for one more. And there's all you can eat. You can take some to go. Gather all you can hold and then go. Go spread the feast. There's always room for one more. There's all you can eat. You can take some to go. Gather all you can hold and then go. Go spread the feast. I think sometimes we don't always connect that when we gather on Sundays, we open our table, that those who might come might eat the same fishes and loaves that we hear in the story. You see, David's kingdom was a kingdom of stone. It was a kingdom of a place. And it was a kingdom in which God was very much present, but wasn't present to the fullness that we might know. When Jesus comes to build his kingdom, he builds it in us, not in a place. That wherever we might go, we might carry that gospel with us. We might carry the feast. And so, unlike David's people, we don't go to Jerusalem, but we go to where we are to find the feast. And so when we break bread, when we share the cup, you're invited to that same feast that we hear about today, that you might be part of the kingdom, that you might be part of God, that you might be part of his grace and love. But here's the challenge. We can't stop there. We have to share. We have to go out into the world and to give back to others. It doesn't really stop where we are. Part of the reason I love when these kinds of things are put together in the lectionary is because it gives all of us, wherever we might be on our spiritual journey, a place to find ourselves. You may be in a place where all you can do is receive God's love right now. You have nothing to give. You may even be in such a place where you just feel that your life is weighted with sin and you don't know quite what to do. Or you may be in a place where you find your life filled with an abundance of God's grace and you have more than enough to share. We kind of move in and out of those different places at different points in our life. But the call remains. In seminary, got a chance to go and to look at lots of stuff. That's what they do. And they often will take you on internships and other places to try to get you to see new and different things or how other people have engaged in ministry. And one winter, Dr. Cook took us to Atlanta, about 25 of us. And he kind of sets you up. He doesn't really tell you anything about anything. And that's kind of his style. And he was a mystery professor. We could never find him except for in class. He had this amazing ability to walk into his office and just to disappear into some closet or something. And so you're always like, where's Charlie? Anybody know where Charlie is? I don't know. I saw him over there. And where's Charlie? I don't know. Yeah, that was the whole thing throughout seminary. So you say, what are we going to do? He says, oh, you'll see. What are we going to do? You're going to get $50 a day to eat, so don't worry about it. And this was kind of how he worked. When we got there, the first day we get up and we're at 6 a.m. We walk into the food pantry at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in downtown, and they kind of just take us in. The first thing you walk into is the mailroom. If you've ever tried to do anything, if you've ever gotten a driver's license or your social security card or anything like that, you may not realize, but you have to have a post office box or some place for them to send you something. And if you don't, they will not give you what you ask for. Go sometime and try to get your driver's license and tell them you don't have an address and see what happens. And so they offer a mailbox for anybody who's homeless, and they have it sorted. So you walk into this room, and there's hundreds of thousands of pieces of mail, all meticulously organized, so that some person that might only show up once or twice throughout the year could come and get their mail, and they can use that P.O. box as their address. Then they take you around the corner, and you find the medical clinic. There's nurses and doctors there caring for people who are on the streets, trying to give them a little bit of comfort and helping them in whatever might ail them. And then you go around another corner, and there's social workers and care workers and others who will sit and talk, and clergy. And then you journey upstairs, and hundreds of people are eating from the abundance of the leftovers of society. It's food gathered at convenience stores and grocery stores that's just almost to the point where it can't be used. but it's immediately made into a feast that any of you would be more than happy to eat. And part of the whole gig is to sit there and to be overwhelmed and to sit down and say, we could never do something like this at the churches I'm going to serve. And then the people who kind of started it, maybe the priest or maybe someone else comes in and we hear the story. And they say, you know, it's kind of funny how it all started. There was a little Bible study of a handful of women and men. And one day they read a gospel, maybe the gospel for today, about feeding. And a couple of them said, you know, we all bring our lunch. Maybe next time we can bring a little extra food. Because there's a lot of people hanging around the church outside that look awfully hungry. And maybe we can help them. This is back in the late 60s and early 70s. And so this little tiny Bible study began making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and taking them out to the people. And then they began to ask questions and to have relationships and to get to know the folks. And then they started saying, well, maybe we could help with that, or maybe we could do something. We've got this big, beautiful church. Maybe we can have a mailbox for you. And over time, these things built up. And that feast was shared. Now, sure, there were people who took advantage of that system, but there were others that just found themselves in circumstances. And that place was able to help them get from nothing to something to somewhere eventually. I think of that as just one of the amazing stories that I've encountered in which when we hear this gospel, we might wonder, how can I make a difference? You see, if you were in that crowd, and maybe you just shared a little and they shared a little, suddenly there's an abundance. So as you go about your week this week, look around and ask yourself, are you at the feast and do you have something to share? Are you at the feast and do you have something to share? Amen.